Having tired of tweaking knobs and pulling levers in the Parolian transport pod, Bobby and Ninkota left to examine other exhibits in the spaceship museum that was located deep within the bowels of Hangar 52. Bobby liked the displays a lot, and was always disappointed he couldn't tell anyone else about them. Like all other facility visitors, he was sworn to top secrecy. To help him keep his little secret, Defense Department administrators had implanted an electrode in his nose. If he ever said the words hangar and 52 together, it would instantly deploy a helium-filled airbag that would lift him 50 feet in the air while making it extremely difficult for the lad to say anything intelligible. Ninkota paused before a display that read, Alien Lifeforms PQR. She scrolled down to number 47 on the list, Parolians, and clicked her mouse on the ant-like icon. The data screen glowed blue-black, then filled with a holographic image of Dr. Frank Baxter. The Parolians, said Dr. Baxter in a mechanically gelatinous voice, first visited the Earth homeworld in 1957. A crash landing in the desert southwest of Roswell resulted in sanguine resettlement at the Hangar 52 facility. They closely resemble the Earth ants in size, number of palpi, and diction, but have a marginally better sense of humor. Like the ant, the Parolian body is comprised of a head, an alley trunk, and a gaster, or caboose. However, the middle segment on the alien torso is used exclusively to carry luggage. Both critters sport metapleural glands, but the Parolians use theirs for species-to-species communication and elimination of bodily waste. We speculate that they move their lips only to confuse their enemies and as attempts at alien ice-breaking humor at parties. Not only do they frequently all think alike, but applied concentration on a single thought produces pheronomic rays which, scientists theorize, can affect the behavior of Algonquin holes in the space-time continuum. The accompanying music track swelled in volume to emphasize the importance of this statement. A video clip showed an artist's conception of an Algonquin hole in a state of stasis, followed by the same hole, presumably under the influence of pheronomic rays, doing the galactic equivalent of the woolly bully. Dr. Baxter continued, continued pheronomic ray production has been shown to cause a kind of massive hysteria among universal constants, even to the point of temporarily discombobulating the natural laws of physics. By projecting this mind shield, the Parolians can change the will of inanimate objects. Even my no-good son-in-law, Boise. And here the normally reserved Dr. Baxter roared with laughter. Composing itself, the hologram continued, the only natural enemy of the Parolians is a carnivorous hydroponic bug from the constellation Scorpius called, as best as we can translate, the Antarian Ant Sucker. But just wait until they meet their first Amway distributor. And again, Dr. Baxter abandoned his staid image of the consummate professional spokesperson and cackled loudly. Ninkota turned off the data screen projection and looked around for Bobby. He was seated before the exhibition of alien ultimatums, a list of threats, both real and imagined, both mischievous and deadly serious, which the Earth had received during the 50-year history of the alien incursion response team. An interactive computer program allowed museum visitors to formulate and present their own demands. Bobby had written several in the past, but today he was just reading. "Did you know that bug blood from a Parolian queen," he said as Ninkutta approached, "makes the best fishing bait in the whole universe?" "Yeah, it's here in the Zontar Ultimatum of 1969. The Zontari had been competing in a galactic fishing contest for 40,000 years and using Parolian blood to reel in some really big astrolunkers. They were way ahead of the other competitors when they ran out of bait and had to detour to the Parolian home world in the Klondike Quadrant. The Parolians didn't like their vital fluids being sucked dry 40,000 years ago, and they didn't look forward to it again, so they left planet. They were apparently heading for sanctuary in the Cleveland sector when their guidance system malfunctioned and they crash-landed here on Earth. After following their space spore for 12 years, the Zontari also arrived at Earth. However, they came with an attitude and an ultimatum. Provide bug juice from 6,580 queen Parolians or be incinerated." Bobby continued to read, but then it was as if someone was watching over the Earth and the Parolians, because an Algonquin hole opened up right in front of the Zontari spacecraft, swallowed them all, then closed and just as suddenly vanished.
"I can't imagine. I just so far can't imagine."
"It's hard to imagine."
"It's very difficult."
"And they haven't been seen since," finished Ninkutta, who'd heard this story many times before. "Come on, let's get some lunch. I'll call to see if they have the oysteroni today." Ninkutta moved the museum phone cursor to the cafeteria symbol and watched as the telephone icon rang and rang and rang. Oddly, no one answered. Ninkutta pressed the stop button, then rekeyed the command, but there was still no answer. Dr. Beezer, meanwhile, had likewise been unable to raise anyone over in the AIRT command center, which was not only highly unusual, but also incompatible with facility regulations. Sensing trouble, he logged onto the Department of Defense's Wallensack supercomputer and accessed the Beezer scope.
Beezer scope.
His own invention,
wow,
which measured distortions in the space-time continuum. As he feared, all communications into and out of the hangar had been suspended pending the arrival of an unidentified sentient entity with humanoid markings through the Algonquin Hole Roswell Gateway. Who on Earth, or off, could it be? And why was he being pursued by... The doctor reconfirmed the Beezer scope's corporeal analysis function. A large sheet of linoleum from the Flambeau-Orange zone.
The Flambeau-Orange zone.
It is a pity, dear listener, that the answer to this and other improbable questions will not be now answered. But consider it a good omen that today's 137th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar will try to make up for it while getting the new year off to a grand start by playing all of your favorite tunes. That is, just as soon as we wade through the stack of CDs which confronts and, yes...
Confounds.
Confounds and, yes, rustles. Ruffles.
Ruffles.
Rustles. The nasaline feathers for the first time in 1998 of Calvos.
You mean we have to wait yet another Calvos and Damien episode to hear about the conclusion of the users of the Beezer scope?
It may be delayed somewhat because I fear that some of us, no names please,
no names please,
a bit weary of the line of thought that the Beezers and the Parolians have been taking.
Not me.
No, of course not.
We're listening to Morton Subotnick's The Wild Bull, the conclusion, and we'll follow it by one of our new releases from Nick Didkovsky. This is from Binky Boy, part two of We'll Ask the Questions Around Here. We'll Ask the Questions Around Here, part two, from the new compact disc, Binky Boy.
Is there a part one? Did we already hear
part
one?
We played it, yeah. We played it when we first received the CD.
I'm trying to remember how it links up with part one.
Yes, via Eagle the Skald.
Oh, right, yes.
Right, which we also played. Actually, we're working our way through. We're now on cut 3 of 16, of 13. Cut 12 will be real interesting because Fred Frith is on that cut along with Mark Howell, Rene Lessier, and Mark Stewart.
Ah, good
so that
band.
Should be a very interesting little what have you with five electric guitars and a computer.
If you're playing these sequentially, we'll get to that in about May 30th?
About that, just in time for our next interview with him. Maine Composers Forum, a new compact disc called New Sounds, Volume 1.
So they got theirs out, did they?
They did. It's a... how does one say in Le Flambeau Orange language the word mutt?
That's as well as it can be said.
Yeah, it's a very... diverse is not quite the word I'm looking for. Mutt. I think
mm-hmm.
mutt.
Yeah.
Here's Nick Humez's... I'm not talking about the individual pieces, but rather the, shall we use a word of multi-syllables, juxtaposition.
Do.
Yes.
Do.
The juxtaposition of tunes, which includes quasi-rock and roll, kind of quasi-political ballads, arrangements of tunes from the Far East, little guitar squiggles of a classical variety, and some blues.
Do we know how these tunes were selected for this recording?
Lottery?
Ah, good.
I'm not
the best
sure.
Way.
Let's listen to Nick Humez, string quartet, Rondo from string quartet number 5 from the new Maine Composers Forum compact disc. Thank you.
The 19th century comes to the 21st.
Well, you just never know what you're going to get on a new release. This is the brand new Maine Composers Forum, New Sounds, Volume 1. That's Nick Humez Rondo from String Quartet Number 5. Doesn't identify the performers anywhere on the compact disc.
Maybe they were just
in hiding?
Yes.
We have one more new release before the Best of the Bizarre.
Oh, that again.
Yeah. This is the brand new release from Lovely Music called Other Places. Just received that this afternoon. This is from Elodie Lawton, who we've heard several times on the show. Very interesting composer. This is Phase 3 from Variations on the Orange Cycle.
Thank you.
Lois Vard playing music of Elodie Lawton, Variations on the Orange Cycle. That's phase three.
It reminded me a little bit of Maria de Alvear if she'd had a lot of coffee and caffeined chocolate.
Right ahead of the yeah, compress those notes.
Yes.
And now?
Why, it must be time for Best of the Bizarre! Mark, I believe, 27.
Oh, my goodness.
Presenting listenable snippets from episodes 131 through 135 in a pleasantly, listenably, snippetly format.
It's because that people can recognize too.
We want some money. And every so often, the neat thing about it, I'd have you as a smiley face. I'd have you as a smiley face. I'd have you as a smiley face. That's it. Yes, exactly. To myself. I said to myself, by that point, I was 10 years old. As we were saying, I wrote quite a lot of crap. So, yes, I wrote quite a lot of crap. As we were saying, I wrote quite a lot of crap. So, yes, I wrote quite a lot of crap.
I have.
So, yes, I wrote quite a lot of crap. As we were saying, I wrote quite a lot of crap. So, yes, I wrote quite a lot of crap.
I have.
And kind of disappointed in my own music. And, in fact, I kind of disappointed in my own music.
So I think that's enough to say about it.
Thank you.
And those silences are pithy.
My mother tells me that it is a very light as a leaf.
Enough to kill a horse, not a whole cavalry.
Do you understand?
Of Halva, 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 of Halva.
Halva loaf was better than none. Best of the Bazaar, Mark 27, listenable snippets from episodes 131 through 135 in a pleasantly homogenized listenable for Matt.
That was one of the best high energy bestos I've heard. That was a goodie. That had my little brain just compressed together like a hard salami sandwich.
Yes, that will do it.
Well, let's slow down the energy a little bit here. And
I know just the way.
By mentioning that you're listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar.
Over.
WGDR Plainfield.
And? That's
it's
all.
January 1998.
Oh. Right.
We're a little late for the beginning of our interview with Sarah Peebles, but it was worth the wait.
Late how? You mean 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Then let's go right to it and maybe
to Toronto, to the .com cafe, in which we set up our little toys and mixers and such, in the understanding that we would be using the space to conduct an interview. That was the understanding of all three of us. Unfortunately, the management hadn't come to the same understanding, apparently, as will become clear when we find ourselves moving now to downtown Toronto and the .com cafe. We are in the .com cafe underneath the neon, the buzzy neon.
Maybe you are. I'm somewhere else entirely. I'm just here in a virtual capacity, so many of my responses will be delayed by several parsecs as I attempt to convey
parsecical display delay.
Right. And convey my interpretation of the conversation from a parallel universe.
In which we will discuss fertilators and a various collection of little things scattered about the table, which shall be known future reference these things, for example, as Peebles.
One can only hope.
One can only hope. Our guest today on the Calvos and Damien... Oh, yes, we have a Paco Peebles with fiber here. Our guest today on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar is Sarah Peebles, who sits before us, one of the Peebles.
I am.
Yes.
A Peebles. One of many.
One of many.
I don't sing jazz, but sometimes I sample it.
Oh, good. We...
first heard of you through a sort of internet-y kind of news release, and you said, "Hello, people." I think it was Rec Music Compose. I'm not sure, but it was one of the news groups. There was this little announcement that said, "You want my CD? Send me a note that says I want your CD."
Really? Did I do that?
Yeah. Either you did it or somebody did it for you.
Someone did it for me.
But it had your name attached at the bottom.
Oh, gee.
And we immediately responded and said, yeah, we'd like that CD, that burnt amber CD that suspended in burnt amber.
That's how it came about.
Yes.
I didn't even know that.
And then we got a note sometime later that said, oh, we're sorry, it's been delayed. And if you really want a copy.
Oh, you got that from the label in Over. In Over Records, they did that.
Yeah, and so we said, oh, well, so much for that. You know, another CD suspended in amber. And then sometime later, I got a note from, I think it was actually you that time, that said, the CD's ready. And so finally, it arrived with the cross-border stamps all over it into our Vermont post office box. And then we played it on the air. We liked it.
Great.
And so we contacted you and said, you know, we'll talk to you. And, well, we don't know a darn thing about you, so you got to tell us.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, you know the plan was I sent out a kind of press release for the CD as well as the Music Works article jointly to a whole bunch of people, thanks to Carl Stone, who told me about the people who truly promised they'll play it if I send it. And you were one of the recommended people.
True Carl, the man of the roast beef.
Hola, Carl.
Yes. Hola, Carl.
So thanks to Carl. So here I am with my pack of people to tell you everything you want to know. I live in Toronto. I'm from Minnesota. I moved here in 1990. I started out writing stuff, and now I don't like to use a pen too much these days. So I started out writing new music, experimental music. Started out playing the violin, really, and then I got interested in composing in high school. And I was active as a composer in high school, writing for traditional Western instruments, kind of interesting combinations of Western instruments and some choral stuff too, and went to the University of Michigan.
Band school. You went to band school? You played violin and went to band school? Now I'm beginning, now I'm suspicious.
Do we have a stigma? Do we have a stigma because of our band?
No, you have reality.
Well, it may be more bandy than it was at the time, but the band always got the promo. The good big boards telling everybody when their concerts were going to be. So I went to Ann Arbor and enjoyed the marching band, you know. I lived across the street from the marching band one summer. It was really nice because they're good. They're really good, and I would go outside just to listen to them practice.
We had a former, a previous guest on our show was in the marching band, and he sang the Victors for us. Can you do the same?
No, I can't. I was never in it, and I didn't memorize their tunes. I listened mostly to their percussion because they had good percussion. I can't. I'm sorry. Maybe I'll sing something else for you sometime.
Something from the Golden Gophers.
Oh, I don't know. I can see Minnesota has left to be. True, while I know who we are, ever done us. True and strong, united are we. Go, Minnesota, rah, 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 hats off to you, all them. And I never went to the U of M. So,
that's pretty good.
I am kind of a Minnesotan. No, I started out being a Minnesotan. Minnesota's changed a lot since I was actually involved in the culture of the Midwest. That moved. Yeah, I've been here since 1990.
And you're dumping your accent very rapidly.
Am I?
Yeah.
Yeah, but if I'm around a bunch of Minnesotans long enough, yeah, sure, you betcha. Yeah, how's it going? Yeah. You bet. Okie dokie.
That's very good. All right, let's go back to the music. Come on, tell us what you did and why you got there. And in your pack of peebles, there's an article in Music Works about your work using Macs, about your sound installations, all kinds of stuff. So bring us up to what date, what you're doing, and how you got to this point.
Well, it was a packed year last year, that's for sure. I was going to school at Michigan, and there's a lot of influences going on in my life, I guess, that led me to where I am now. And I was composing avant-garde stuff, studying with all of the teachers they throw at you there, like William Albright, William Bolcom, George Wilson, Fred Lairdahl. Yeah, and so I had a kind of an interesting experience there, and I took basic electronic music there and learned some basic things about electronic music. And tape splicing, I became a very good tape splicer because I had a beautiful, beautiful tape splicing studio.
But you grew into the digital age and you were still splicing away, really?
Well, it was 1983. I was an undergrad in 83, and we all know that University of Michigan doesn't allow their undergrads into the grad equipment room. The Sinclair, that was a mystery. But I actually did get to work with the Sinclair once with a grad student who was really nice and helped me make a little bit of snippet of material to include in one of my pieces.
A snippet. Those are tape terms. I think you're bound into the tape era somehow.
Well, it was. That piece was.
Oh, okay.
We took a tabla sound and we stretched it. It was after the attack of the tabla, and stretched the attack, the resonating sound of it out in the Sinclair and captured that on tape. And it was used on tape in a piece I wrote in 1988. And so that's what was going on there in college. And I took lots of time out in college because it was driving me crazy. And it was just very kind of intense experience that didn't always have positive vibes around there. So I went AWOL for a while. I went to Japan.
How do you get to Japan? I mean, just pick up and leave?
Well, you know, as a junior, I was going to be a junior that year. And I decided in order for me to graduate from this institution without changing institutions, with a healthy, happy attitude, I'd better take some time off. And I had been a student of Seeley Humphreys in Minnesota. He's a conductor, and he had done one of his concerts was devoted to the music of the Pacific Rim. So in high school, I'd heard of Itaki Mitsu and other people from Japan. And I thought, well, this is, you know, really an interesting slice of the contemporary music scene. And so why don't I go there and check it out? I mean, I could, thinking of what am I going to do with a year off? You know, do I want to go to Paris? Do I want to go to, you know, do I want to go to New York? What do I want to do? And, well, my decision was influenced by the fact that I was really actively learning judo since high school. And my high school social studies teacher, Mr. Sudo, was a very...
What was his real name?
Mr. Sudo.
No, what was his real name?
Yoshimasu. Yosh.
Okay.
Yosh was a very important staple of the judo scene of the Midwest, and at least at one time he was. And he had a club that started me off. And when I was going to college at the University of Michigan, something just drew me to be very physically involved learning judo, because I think it was the pressure. And it's the pressure of a lot of studying, and the pressure actually of, I think, some of the less positive aspects of being in a music school. And I think those are going to happen in many, many music schools have those. And those aspects of people, you know, insisting you prove yourself and crap like that. And there was the added pressure, I believe, of having been the only woman there and with a bunch of boys and a couple men who were really very into, you know, kind of butting heads and proving themselves. And I just didn't grow up with that. And so I think that drove me to put my heart into a couple other things. One of them was judo. And besides that, I like sports. I've always really been into sports. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Japan. I want to see how far I can get in judo, because my category, 48 kilos and under, has very few international competitors. I might as well just go for it, see how far I get. So I went to, I enrolled in a music school in Tokyo with some friends. I had connections. I got in the music school, and I lived right next door to a place where I could practice judo every day, but I lived next door to a shrine. I mean, not the school, but rather the dormitory. It was next door to a shrine. And I got some wonderful introductions from the priest, the Shinto priest, who I became friends with, to traditional music scene in Japan. And I adopted two teachers and two completely different music disciplines who didn't and shouldn't know about one another. And I studied festival music, which is a very folk music kind of thing. Edo no Matsuri Ba'ashi. this isn't the naked man with the big drums thing. This is kind of sitting, kneeling with small drums and some flutes and stuff. And it's actually a traveling theater. They do more than that. They do a couple of different kinds of music. I studied that. And then I also studied court music through a very semi-professional kind of not that highly recommended a place, actually. It's the Tokyo Association of Shinto Priests, and it was a group for non-musicians, really, to learn gagaku. Some of them are musicians, and so it wasn't a really high-end learning environment for gagaku. I mean, I learned slowly and with amateurs. On the other hand, it fulfilled another purpose of mine, and that was to understand the role of music in Japanese society, the contemporary society. Why does this stuff still exist? That's the first thing that goes through, I'm sure, many people's minds as foreigners when they get there. They think to themselves, well, why is it here still? Does anyone care? And how is it here? And definitely it goes through the mind of a composer, or at least my mind. So that was a slice of life for me in Japan for the first 9 months in 1985-86. And then I also did judo 6 times a week.
Wow.
And I also explored it was great, but it got me really injured too, because I actually was not 48 kilos at the time. I was 38 kilos.
What?
I was 88 pounds.
I just calculated there real quick. Yeah.
And no, I'm not anorexic. I'm 4'10 and 88 pounds, since people can't see me. I'm not 88 pounds anymore, but I was then. And so I got a lot of injuries because no one's my size. But anyway, I had a great time and doing music and judo. And I came back to University of Michigan after that.
Well, that influence has stayed with you the whole time. I think yeah. Let's listen to something.
Mm-hmm.
What shall we hear? Do you have something from that era, or shall we listen to one of the new pieces?
Well, how about the first piece on Suspended in Amber? Because
sure.
That is the first piece I wrote for the show, which is a court music instrument. It's a mouth organ. And I came back, and about, I think, a year later, I was able to get myself a show in good working order lent to me from the Stearns Collection of the University of Michigan, thanks to Professor William Malm, who paid to have it fixed. I sat around and I goofed around on it, and I came up with a piece that kind of reflected some traditional stuff I'd learned and some new things I was trying out. And it's performed by someone I have a lot of respect for. His name is Kou Ishikawa, and he's a really good, wonderful new music performer and traditional music performer on the show.
Great. And the name of the piece is?
Blue Moon Spirit.
Blue Moon Spirit. I have it on the top of my mind. We played it twice already on the show. It's a great piece.
Really?
Yeah, Blue Moon Spirit. Here it is, music by Sarah Peebles. you're saying? Nothing is ironic?
Not on this show.
Oh.
We take into consideration all contingencies.
Check, check, check.
One, two,
check.
One, two.
Check, check, check. No, we're not asking for the check. This is by itself.
It is. You can, wow, can make your own mix, the KNG.com mix.
.com mix, yes. We're speaking with, aside from the check, we're speaking with Sarah Peebles, and that was Blue Moon Spirit from her new compact disc, Suspended in Amber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope they get the sound check figured out.
Well, I hope they learn to count to higher than two at some point. It'd be much more interesting. Maybe it's a binary sound check.
We could ask.
Ask which part? Whether it's a binary sound check?
We could ask them that too. And we can ask them when they're going to be done with their sound check.
We could. Well, why don't we just sign off briefly here.
All right.
Check.
Check one, two. Check, check, check. One, two, one, two. Check one, two. Start with the half here. Check one, two. Check one.
It was beginning to become interesting.
Yes,
a mantra from the .com cafe.
It was indeed. Let's play a little piece in between there. That was just almost an impossible situation. There are pauses in moments when we're speaking because we absolutely cannot concentrate with this. They were selling shoes. Wasn't it a shoe exhibition?
It was to be, yes, with lighting and a microphone and an announcer.
Well, let's listen to a brief piece called Nocturnal Premonitions, music by Sarah Peebles.
Back to thumps now instead of check, 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 check. I think, would you think that maybe Kafka would be happy about that?
Pinter would.
Pinter, yes.
Pinter would do something with this, I believe.
Would he feel the groove? I feel the groove.
Oh, yeah. Sarah Peebles, back on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar. So you got back to America after how long in Japan?
Yeah. Well, it was only 9 months. It was my initial 9 months. And mind you, I didn't speak Japanese at the time. I tried to learn from a book. And let this be a warning to everyone out there. Don't try to do that. It doesn't work. So I got a little ways studying traditional music there with my limited language skills. And then I should, you know, return then to finished my degree at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Wow, that must have been, speaking of culture shock, in each direction.
Yes, it was a huge culture shock in each direction. And the culture shock goes on and on, and it never really stops. I mean, usually I don't live in culture shock, but I've had many repeated episodes going there and coming back. And I luckily got to study Japanese language while I was finishing my music degree. And luckily for me, it was a new program that stressed speaking ability instead of reading ability. So I became actually pretty okay communicator in Japanese. And so that's helped me a lot. And that's why I've gone back, now and then.
So you've been back how many times?
I've been back 3 times. So I've been there 4 times altogether.
Yeah. So, carry us through the musical influences,
yeah,
how you got
so.
To use using computers, doing installations.
Right. So after I, continued to do more of the regular acoustic instrumental composition and basic electronic music at Michigan, then I went back after graduating to Japan, and I hung out and did really intense traditional music study, and then I came and I moved here to Toronto.
Now, why Toronto? What attracted you?
It's got kind of two streams of thought. One of them was I was working with a dancer here, Renee Highway, who unfortunately passed away quite tragically a couple years ago, but at the time we were collaborating, and we had a gig in Minnesota to do a remounting of a piece that he helped me do when I was still in Michigan. He was dancing for a piece that I created for dancer and percussion and tape and narrator. And so I wanted to work on that with Renee here in Toronto. And the other stream of thought, or stream of consciousness, maybe I can say, that comes into it is I had come here, I had driven here in 1988 to be a part of the Toronto Morris Ale. Morris Ale. The Morris dancing. I was a part of the Ann Arbor Morris team, and I played folk fiddle and I danced Morris. So I came up here for the ale.
Well, now this is a whole. Difference.
I know. Life is like that, And my car broke down. I hung out. I heard Nexus. I heard the Glass Orchestra. I met a lot of really nice composers when my car broke down, and I thought, okay, well, I might as well just hop the border and see if I can maybe get legal someday here and see if I like it and work with Renee, Highway and all these things made sense. And it was close to Michigan. All my stuff was in Michigan anyway. And so I moved here. And when I came, at that point, moving here, coming back from Japan, I just didn't know what to do with myself. I had been so engrossed and involved as an apprentice of folk music and gagaku stuff. Coming back, I just didn't know what to do with myself. And I had met a very nice composer here, Bentley Jarvis, who is a professor at the Ontario College of Art, and introduced me to someone across the street, literally, at the University of Toronto Electrical Engineering Department, who likes music and had a DX7 and an Akai sampler and a soundproof room.
And this is what year?
1990.
Sort of a heyday of the
DX7. I didn't learn how to use the DX7, I just ended up using it as a MIDI control thing that I guess, what did it do? It played back, I forget by now, anyway. I used it in a MIDI capacity that had, unfortunately, I missed out on that. It's a nice instrument, but I can't say I know it. But I started to sample things, and I started to sample my Japanese instruments, the sho and some beautiful bells that are used in Buddhist prayer. And eventually I got together with a calligrapher who was introduced to me in Toronto. He was visiting. He was from Japan. And he said, oh, let's do something together. And he said, sure, why not? Yeah, let's. And I said, oh, here's my idea. And I told him, and he didn't really like it. And I said, well, okay, why don't you come up with an idea and show me? So he came up with this whole scenario that suggested a lot of sound. He wanted me to, have dawn sounds, and it was, bird sounds in the morning and stuff like that. And his concept was a Buddhist concept known as revolving life, kind of, or revolving revolution home away didn't make any show, and so you know, the idea of return and can be returning lives after you die, or the seasons, so that whole idea of, you know, the wheel, things going round and round. And that got me out into the environment, sampling the water at Lake Ontario on Toronto Island, and the crickets there, and borrowing from the Voice of the Loon CD, which is an Audubon release. And
yes, I have that.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. You know all about how not to disturb them when they're nesting.
Right.
I liked the idea of taking the language groups that we've observed of loons, not just any old loon sound, but their communication, their language, cells of language, and using them musically that way. And I wrote to William Barklow, and I said, you know, do you care? And he said, go for it, no problem. And I thought it'd be nice to have contact with the person who made the recording, instead of just taking it, you know. Well, this is just how I felt at the time.
Let's listen to something else while they do
sound check
number two. What do we hear?
How about the summertime excerpt of Tomoe, Revolving Life? You can hear the loons in the background in that, and the ever-present bugs surrounding the actual temple that we did the piece in.
Great.
And some of the wonderful Japanese cicada that I sampled and incorporated into our performance.
Beautiful. Music by Sarah Peebles.
Thank you.
Well, we're back briefly during the
check. Can you hear me?
It's our people.
One, two.
All right, well, talk about installations for a while. You got these lovely installations and well, there's a whole character to the sound and the. I haven't been to the installations, but we see these terrific outdoor installations and these calligraphic things and this music. Can you tie that together in like 5 minutes?
Maybe I can. I can tell you that I'm not really an installation artist as such, and so I've done a few things. And the true kind of installation work I did was in collaboration with Robert Cruikshank, who's a composer-based, a Toronto-based composer.
Composer-based Toronto.
That's right. And this was in Japan, and I was in Japan anyway doing some work. And so he came, and he had been making the circuitry for these by himself in his apartment before coming over and putting a lot of it together. And I had this idea that I originally passed by a mixed media artist, Hirotoshi Sakaguchi, who has this beautiful car buried in the grounds. No one knows how they got it there. It's buried and it's planted with moss. It's got some rope in a spider web like configuration above it, attached to trees around it, with water hosing that has water running through it because it's attached upstream to a stream, and it goes down up around the car and back down to downstream where it empties out. What an elegant idea. Well, I saw this when I went to a festival a friend of mine told me about in 1989, or maybe it was 1990. And that was in Hakushu, Japan. And this is a festival that has a lot of butoh dance and visiting performers from other parts of Asia or Europe. And it's run by Min Tanaka anyway. It's run by a commune of butoh dancers. They have this festival, and they have this component of outdoor installation art. And you walk through all these farmers' fields to get to all of these different places. So we wanted to make some sound to go with this very mysterious car. And
it is an incredibly mysterious car. We have a photograph of it here, and the car itself almost looks like it's made out of something else. It looks like it's sort of made out of mud.
Yeah,
it's like a golem car. You know?
Yeah, say that. Well, you know, maybe it's becoming more of a golem car every year, I suppose. And it's the sound environment around it has changed considerably since it was planted. It was planted when there were a bunch of trees around it, which were give it a lot of quietness. And the trees were cut down because they were grown there to be shiitake trees anyway, trees that farmers use to grow shiitake under. When they reach a certain maturity, they're cut down. It's a very small growth. And so there's a lot of insects and stuff now around there, buzzing and hot sunlight. We were staying in a farmer's house, which is a beautiful place, old rundown farmer's house that we were renting. The whole group of artists, of installation artists, was renting. And it was a commune, a communal kind of setting. And we just set our stuff up on the tatami mats. And Rob brought his welding and soldering equipment, or rather his soldering equipment and his boards, and was finished his circuitry in the house. And the circuitry had some small sound chips. This is the beginning of the sound chip market. This is when sound chips were $100 for 20 seconds.
You mean the
digital.
The digital recording chips.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I came up with a design to put the sound in these chips in a certain way, a certain order, not just samples, but my samples are arranged to be performed back in an improvisatory manner or a way that you could predetermine.
Yeah.
But at any rate, the point is it's going to change every time you do it, or you can be real flexible with the sound. So I thought of a design, and I put little vignettes, little what was it, 10-second vignettes in these chips.
This is really interesting. This is going to be really interesting to talk about, because what year was this?
1993.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay. Continue with this, and we'll have there's some interesting parallels here.
So I was designing this to go into the circuitry in the tatami mat space of this old house. It was a wonderful place to work in, except that we had to make sure I was grounded so I didn't get killed, because tatami mats are kind of damp, or at least they're connected to the earth. But we're in this real rural setting, and it's really, you know, beautiful around there. And so the general idea behind this is that there are speakers planted around the car, eight speakers. They're actually just kind of set by trees and camouflaged. They're very small, mini speakers, and you probably can't really see them unless you look. And the sound is random. You don't know when it's going to happen. And it might happen every 3 minutes. It might happen in 30 seconds. And it's going to swirl around you in a circular fashion. And there are two circuits in two different Tupperware boxes, which we actually had to plant beneath the wheels of the car. So we got our shovels out and dug up the earth again, put these boxes in, covered it up, took the wires and ran them under the ground, planted them to all the speakers and to the solar panel that powers the batteries. And covered it all up again, replanted the moss and the grass over it, and we hope it's still there. It's supposed to function all the time, forever. That's that kind of setup. It doesn't require any external help. And so the sounds were, I had to pick things that wouldn't be obtrusive, because I had to think, oh, how's it going to work in winter? How's it going to work in summer, day, night? So I picked some cricket sounds, North American crickets. They kind of come in and out, and some water gurgles come in and out, and some bells. These cup gongs, these small Buddhist temple bells I have sampled, they kind of come in and out. And they just come in different configurations, in and out. And it's pretty simple and basic. And we didn't want to detract from the power of the site anyway. The site is really quite mesmerizing just the way it is. And that is what we ended up being able to pull off, and real happy with. There's a crick right next to it, so sometimes you confuse between what's the crick and what's the installation, depending on where you're standing. And people had real nice positive reactions to it, and that was our experience in the mountains. That's the only true installation that I've done in the installation.
This is such a wonderful connection, because in 1991, I think it was. Yes, it was 91. It was just before I went to Europe. I did an installation called Traveler's Rest. And as part of this installation, which actually consisted of building, I worked with a sculptor by the name of Fernanda D'Agostino from Washington State. She built some buildings, small buildings on the site. We grew grain on the site. And as part of the installation, I had those same sound chips, by the way. I'm sure they were the same ID, S or IDI or whatever the name of the brand was, sound chips. And I had buried speakers along the pathway and around the building. And the sounds were not, some of the sounds were samples that were actually on tape loops. Those were the fixed sounds that were run by a small computer inside one of the buildings. The non-fixed sounds were sounds of people who would visit the site. Their speech would be picked up by the microphones, stored in those chips, and then randomly brought back at different times, either immediately or shortly thereafter, or sometimes a day later, that piece of sound would be played back along this site, along these paths.
And what was the mechanism that triggered the chips to pick up their voices?
It was randomly done. If there was a sound in progress, I had a randomization kind of a program running that would decide whether or not to store the sound.
Wow.
And that was...
Isn't that an interesting bit of synergy?
And there was something... Oh, and of course the site also was self-powered, but we used a windmill and batteries because there was no power on that site either. So,
that's wonderful.
Ours was vandalized 10 days later, however, forever was not in its future.
Oh, no. We don't know if ours is alive or not. And we had this challenge of trying to decide how to do something way out in a field, really not next to anything. And how to make it be something that would last a really long time. So Walkmans ended up not being a very practical idea, and computers, of course, were out of the question. So that's what led Rob to decide on that technology, and I'm less familiar with that kind of technology than he is. So I was, we were both in on it conceptually, and I was, you know, thinking of specific sounds, and he was thinking of how to make it work, and that's what we came up with. Now, the same week, because we were in this wonderful place, there was another installation I'm particularly fond of, which is a copper-plated, geometrically designed thing that sits. It's just almost like a table, an interestingly shaped copper table, not very high above the earth in a bamboo grove. Now this, luckily, is not so far from the farmer's house who tends the whole area, including the bamboo grove. And the farmer is really nice. I watched the guy make this, the person who was friends with the farmer. I watched Hank Ter Kulve from the Netherlands make this and another site several years earlier at Hakshu Art Camp. And I wanted to play there because I really like the sounds that came up in this bamboo grove, especially around 11 a.m. in the morning. And the lights around 11 a.m., I noticed, struck the copper in this really nice way. That was the angle of the sun. It just seemed like a good time. So I got together with a koto player who was there anyway, assisting one of the improvisers. There was a gathering of improvisers who were playing with Derek Bailey that year. And one of them was Sawai Kazue, who is a pretty well-known koto player. She had a student who was quite interested in doing something with me. So a week ahead of time, I talked to the farmer. I said, well, what do you think, you know? And she said, oh, yeah, no, you know, sure. And, you know, we just kind of got to know the guy. You know, I didn't really want to just invade. I just, you know, it was the festival said, oh, do what you want, you know, because we already have their permission. And I thought, well, it would be kind of nice if I was more personable about this, and being that I can communicate somewhat in Japanese. We hung out with him a bit. He was real nice, and he ended up providing us a really, really long power cord for my computer, and he invited all of the other farmers in his neighborhood to come. And that was really interesting, because they're all like over 60 or 50. And just another zone, you know. I think experimental music is something that they've ever thought about or could care less about, you know, needless to say.
Sort of like here. Well, maybe not Toronto.
Well, if you're a farmer, and, you know, what do you have on your mind? Farming, right? That's natural. So anyway, they came, and they were interested because, you know, foreigners are, you know, kind of spices your day up. And they thought it was... I think they thought it was pretty funny because I was accessing sampled sounds of cicada that I had taken just up the mountain a couple years earlier at one of their local shrines that has these wonderful cicadas known as higurashi, and they come out around 4 p.m. in August, and they sound like birds, and they're actually bugs. And I incorporated them and some other local insects into what I was doing. So, you know, as you've figured out by now, I'm pretty much in the terrain of timbral performance of, you know, or timbral orientation and motion and different kinds of gestures, gestural performance, not really being concerned with melodies and things like that. And we really had a wonderful time in that bamboo grove, and the things around us reacted to us in a real subtle way, the way bugs will do. Only the bugs in Japan are pretty loud because it's semi-tropical. And to me, that's really engaging and interesting because it's not like Minnesota, where I grew up. And so I rather enjoyed that. That wasn't an installation, but I've always, you know, kept these things in my memory. And recently, the most recent installation it's like an installation that I've done was a local park called the Village of Yorkville Park in Toronto. Has a mini marsh and
a mini marsh,
M-A-R-S-H, and a boardwalk and a little corridor and a bunch of trees all in the space of a quarter block, and it's lit in a very interesting way. It's made by an architectural group here, and So it's not just a park, it's an architectural park. And it has a big boulder in it.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And
we'll get back to the park. Let's hear another piece of music while we have a chat.
Okay.
What do we hear?
Good day. 1, 2, 3.
I'm giving you, you can hear this strange nature, which I'm giving you maybe the first 10 minutes of it. This is the soundtrack from the video of Strange Nature in the park. And then we can talk about it.
Good. When we get back, music by Sarah Peebles.
Before we go to Strange Nature, music by Sarah Peebles, just to mention that this is our music unseen, music from or for places and spaces show.
Ah, I see.
Yes.
That was something that Beezer didn't mention on his Beezer scope. He didn't see it. There were many things he didn't see, but I see the illusion. It works.
It works. So we will be back at the end of the show with a list of what we're about to play. We will play Sarah Peebles' piece, and we will move directly from that into some other pieces about from or for places and spaces. So starting right out now with music by Sarah Peebles, Strange Nature.
And this, of course, all occurring.
Oh, yes, because it's not the hour, but it will be.
It will be.
On WGDR Plainfield.
A lot of disciplines coming together to make an environment, both a sound, a visual environment, and also to give a certain feeling and also hopefully transform the audience. So our physical activity also produces sound, because we are our whole movement vocabulary is derived from playing the strings. It's like a musician playing stringed instrument. If you look at a violinist who's very passionate, they have their whole vocabulary of movement that is dance in itself. So that's what's interesting about this.
It's all kind of strangely natural, because I'm commenting on nature, yet I'm not really presenting it as the pure samples that it would be. I'm mixing up a bunch of sounds that remind people of things they know, yet which have been reproduced in an unusual manner that may remind them of a dream. I've gathered lots of different sounds from Japan and North America, and I've arranged them in the computer in a really flexible way in which I can perform with them live.
This is the Henri de Martinot, the Frenchman, inventor, technician, and also a musician called Maurice Martinot, invented it in the 20s. I don't know what it's going to be, but maybe a very strange but a very exciting experience for us and for you.
Come on. Answer? Only the truth, disguised in a dream.
seems to have slowed somewhat.
Music unseen, music from or for places and spaces. You're listening to excerpts from Kai by Sarah Peebles. Let's take that from the top. We started with Sarah Peebles' Strange Nature, followed that by Clarence Barlow's CCU, which was a composite of sounds in Calcutta from the early 1980s. Then Carl Stone's Young Jump, made of sounds from Tokyo, and then from 1196, also by Carl Stone, the first section of that. Then George Todd's piece derived from syllables and sounds in an echoing space, Creati. This almost sounds like I should put on my music from the Hearts of Space.
Right. Yes, I'm just getting ready for a nice hot bath.
Following George Todd's Creati, a love song, music by Pauline Oliveros, played on her just intoned accordion.
Yes.
And then for tuba and electronics, Llama Butter by Dennis Bathory Kitts. What places and spaces might that be, actually recorded in Colorado?
The llamas that were.
The llamas.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Then played in Indiana and mixed in Vermont. So places and spaces there. That was followed by Benedict Mason's Lighthouses of England and Wales.
That's W-H-A-L-E-S?
One could only hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then Line of Apogee, film music by Vladimir Ussachevsky.
Ah, the old, yes.
Yes. And then music for, for Place or Space. It has just gone by me as to what it was for. Yannis Xenakis' Orient Occident. Orient Occident, that itself a place or a space. This created for, that was created for a film conceived for UNESCO as illustrative music of time and space from Alexander the Great to the present.
You'll get no argument from me.
No argument at all. And then Eleanor Hovda's Coastal Traces, Tide Pools 2. That's certainly places and spaces, that from her CD Coastal Traces. And then Maggie Payne's Apparent Horizon, yet another place.
Yeah?
Yes. That actually is a video as well as an audio composition, done both. And then we follow that up by Biogenesis by Eliane Radig, which has a subtitle of some kind that I have forgotten that has to do with time and space. And then Peter Van Riper's Heart.
Yes, of course.
Speaking of time.
Right, yes. I agree.
From his Music for Spaces compact disc. And then Detritus of Mating by Dennis Bathory Kitts, a piece created of voices for the space of the Exquisite Corpse Gallery in Vermont.
Which has recently seen a change of venue.
Yes, and later to another place. That followed by John Gibson's Relative Calm. And finally, what we're hearing, the excerpts from Kai by Sarah Peebles. Music for places and spaces, and we're about done. Look us up at www.maltedmedia.com. Look for Calvos with your web searcher. We'll be back with more energy, less energy, more space, less space, who knows what, and the second half of our interview with Sarah Peebles next week.
Plus, whatever else befalls the station.
Befalls the station, that is truly the word.
a production of Multimedia.